we're starting on time, so any stragglers, just continue coming in. Now, I've had several people, well, I'm Rhonda Lair, a psychiatrist. I was going to say, because I was wearing black today, that I am the villain in a James Bond movie, but I'm just Rhonda Lair, psychiatrist on the board of the Ogden Surgical Medical Society for the last 27 years. I've had people say it was hard to hear in this room. So, Teresa, can you back there hear me? It's just an example of hearing clearly. Everyone can hear okay? Okay, but I would like to say to the next speaker is just you got to sort of stay in the microphone. When we shift to feel, people say they can't hear. Okay, I'm very proud to present Lynn Kerr, and she has a really interesting CV, and one of my colleagues just said she didn't come here yesterday because her daughter had a headache. Dr. Kerr received her medical degree from the University of Utah School of Medicine after receiving her PhD in neurophysiology from the University of Virginia. She then completed her pediatric and neurology child-adolescent residencies at the U of U. She has been a physician at Shriners Hospital and the University of Utah Health Science Center for the Division of Pediatric Neurology. She's also a pediatric neurologist for the Child Development Clinic at CSHCN. She's currently Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Utah in the Division of Pediatric Neurology and Primary Care Hospital, and she's very interested in helping families of children with special health care needs negotiate primary and subspecialty care, and let's help her. Dr. Kerr is the Medical Director for Spinal Bifida Clinic. She's involved in the Medical Home Portal and for primary care physicians and children with special needs, and she is the Physician Champion for the medical home demonstration. We've heard about that yesterday, for the Division of Pediatric Neurology. She's also a clinical advisory board of the Cornelia de Lange, did I pronounce that right? De Lange Syndrome Foundation. Second only to the diagnosis of seizures, the pediatric neurologists at the Primary Children's Hospital are referred many children and adolescents with headaches. Dr. Kerr has taken special interest in this population, board certifying in headache medicine through the United Council of Neurologic Subspecialties, focusing on the headache clinic of which she is co-director, and initiating or participating in several research projects regarding management of children, adolescents with chronic headache, including a mindfulness study. And I should be mindful to tell you that we're having a lecture on mindfulness today at lunch. And the mindfulness management with primary care physicians. And she hopes to improve our headache clinic in the future, adding to other disciplines, interdisciplinary, and more education for families. So, eagerly, I await. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you. Can you guys hear me okay? I think I have two microphones. So good morning, my name's Lynn Kerr from Pediatric Neurology. I'm the director of the Headache Clinic. I'm going to have some time at the end for questions. This one's not working? Yeah? But please feel free to interrupt me. So this is what one patient has drawn as what his headaches look like. Headaches occur in everybody. Including children and adolescents, very common. And hopefully you'll feel better treating them after I talk today. So headache is one of the top five health problems in children, and one of our second most common diagnosis. And we haven't done the numbers recently. I actually think that probably headache is more than seizures right now in our clinic. So calls, many calls every day from outside physicians trying to get people in quicker for headaches because parents really panic. So you have to have patience with children with headache. This young lady looks like she doesn't feel well. But then you also have these kinds of kids that look like they could be playing with an iPad or running up and down the corridor with their siblings. And sometimes it's really hard to take them as seriously. And I do try to remember that there are a lot of psychological factors in some children with headache, not everybody. So I wanted to start with a case study. 14-year-old girl comes into clinic complaining of severe headaches. She gets the headaches one or two times a month. She had motion sickness when she was little. When she says she has a headache, she goes like this. It's bilateral across the forehead. She says it's throbbing, and she wants to lie down in a dark room and go to sleep. And her mom and her aunt both get bad migraines. So what else do you want to know? Anyone? Did she what? Anything else? No visual symptoms. Vomiting, nausea. So I wanted to bring up that at this point, you're going to be thinking to yourself, what are the red flags? I'm going to be talking about chronic headache today, but I also don't want you to miss the rhino when the doctor thought it was kidney stones. So it's very important to be thinking, even if you think it's just a regular headache. So the red flags are a very young child. I get a lot more nervous if it's a three-year-old. If it's a new onset headache and it's horrible, if the onset was really abrupt, if the symptoms are progressively getting worse, if there are abnormal neurologic signs when you examine the child, obviously, if the headache gets worse with exertion, if the headache changes with the head position so they can lie down, the headache goes away, they stand up, and the headache gets worse, or vice versa. If it changes with the Valsalva maneuver, if they have a headache and vomiting in the morning. Now, a lot of people think that this is an indication to get an MRI or CT, and actually, many, many migraines start in the morning. So it's not a definite indication, but if it seems to get better as they stand up. And personality change, that to me is kind of okay. That might be a tumor. So this slide shows some of the time courses of headache. The girl that I was just talking about is represented by the purple line. So she's absolutely fine between her headaches, and then the headaches get worse at times. This green line represents a child with chronic daily headaches. They have a headache every single day, but sometimes it gets worse. This black line, that's a really worrisome headache. That's a headache that's going to need imaging. It came on, it's getting to be very, very severe. And I also worry about the kids who just over a couple of years get worse and worse. So a little bit more about the history. These were some of the questions you all asked. So she's had the headaches for several years. They've stayed about the same. They're present in the morning, but they don't get better. They don't change as she changes position. She mostly gets nausea and vomiting, and her review of systems is normal, except for frequent abdominal pain. And she saw her primary care provider without a cause being found. That's a really common accompaniment with headache. There's an entity that people are calling MUPS now, which is medically unexplained physical symptoms. And these are the kids that come in, they have stomach aches, they have headaches. I had one family that was so upset by their daughter's various pains that they ended up going to the Mayo Clinic for a diagnosis and got a diagnosis of chronic pain syndrome. And the mom called me up like a year later and said, now she has a diagnosis. And I felt like, oh my gosh, what did I miss? And she says, pelvic pain. So that's another one. So this poor young lady has pain for everything and is going to three or four different pain clinics right now. We don't have really good pain clinics for children. So it's really difficult when you get one of these kids. So on physical exam, her vital signs are normal, including her blood pressure. She's alert and interactive. Her weight's normal. There's a lot of stuff in the literature about being overweight being a cause for headache. And I don't typically see that in the population that I see. I actually see kind of thin overachievers who are doing swimming and dance and everything else. But it is in the literature. And her general and neurologic exams were normal. What if I told you that she was overweight with a BMI of 29? She has floaters in her vision. She's on minocycline for acne. And she may have some peripheral vision loss to confrontation testing. So this is a normal fundoscopic exam, which I'm sure you guys have all seen. But this young lady has papilledema. So she has pseudotumor cerebri. So I was taught in medical school to use the term pseudotumor cerebri, and then for the next 10 or 15 years, I was told not to use that anymore. I was supposed to use idiopathic intracranial hypertension. And now we're being told not to use that anymore, to go back to the pseudotumor cerebri syndrome. And that's because they want to have this, whether it's primary, you can't think of a reason for it, or secondary, maybe a medicine, venous sinus thrombosis, or others. So it's really important that you need the MRI changes and the fundoscopic changes and maybe visual problems for the diagnosis. It is not just dependent on whether you go in there and do an LP and it's 320, because it's really hard to do a good LP and sedation changes it. So if they have a high pressure, but they don't have any vision changes, they don't have any fundoscopic changes, they don't have any problems with the retina, it's not pseudotumor. It's just maybe a little bit of high pressure to give it a headache. The paper of Friedman et al. Will be in the references on the end of the talk if you want to know more about this. So no matter how you look at pediatric headache, headaches in children are incredibly common, and again, one of the most likely health complaints. There are many, many papers about prevalence. So in Germany in 2012, that's the latest one I can find, about 20% of children coming into clinics had headaches. About 10% of those were migraine. Calculated lifetime prevalence is almost 60%. About 10% of children seem to have migraines in this study. And in this study, it was a headache clinic. They looked at children under 7, and about half of them had migraine. So even kids under 7. So it's not unusual for kids that age to have migraine, and it's not an absolute indication to send to pediatric neurology. So then we move on to headache classification. Why do we want to classify headache? How we choose to evaluate them, for how we choose to manage them. And we classify by the International Headache Society criteria. And as we go to ICD-10, most likely the more specific diagnosis you can make, the better you will get paid. So the first classification is just whether they're primary headaches or secondary headaches. So obviously primary is just a pain syndrome, whereas secondary is secondary to something else. The lines blur, though. So you can be treating a 14-year-old young lady with migraines, and they've been really typical for years. And then all of a sudden, those headaches get worse, and you do an MRI at that point, never having done one before, and she has a brain tumor. So if you get a brain tumor and you have migraines, you are more likely to present with migraine-like headaches with that brain tumor. So you always have to keep that in mind. So primary headaches, migraine, tension, they don't tend to come to neurology very often. The tacts, the trigeminal autonomic cephalgias, again, we don't get too many of those in pediatrics, but sometimes we do. There's also stabbing or ice pick headaches. Those aren't supposed to be seen in pediatrics, but I get a lot of those, actually. And the kids come in, and they say they have this stabbing pain for about 15 seconds, and it goes, but it might happen many times a day. Hemicrania continua, so they just hurt on one side of their head all the time. And then there's a new classification called new daily persistent headache, or NDPH. And those kids can say, I was driving home from gymnastics on the second weekend in February, and my headache started, and it's been there ever since. And then the ones we all dread, chronic daily headaches. Doctor, I've had a headache for the last 2 years, and I haven't gone to school in a year. Vestibular migraine is a new headache type seen by a lot of ENT, often before surgery. So they get dizziness as a migraine equivalent, not necessarily headaches, although some of them have headaches. And that brings up a point. I was talking to an ENT here that I went to medical school with, and they get many, many specialties see these patients before they come. So they go to ophthalmology, maybe their eyes are wrong. They go to ENT, maybe they have sinus problems, and so on. So the two major subtypes, as you all know, are migraine with and migraine without aura. Both of them are caused by abnormalities in the trigeminal vascular system. As you all know, there are no pain receptors actually in the brain. They're in the vasculature and the meninges surrounding the brain. And in people with migraine, those receptors and those pain pathways are altered. There's new evidence that was just presented by a resident a couple of weeks ago at the university, where you could see differences in the nerves in the cornea. That part of the trigeminal nerves over time in people with migraine compared to not migraine. We don't know that if we treat those patients, whether those changes, but it's the first evidence of a neuropathy in people with migraine. People have talked about it a long time. Serotonin is involved in migraine, as is glutamate, and serotonin agonists, the HT1B and 1D receptors, are involved, and if you the triptans are agonists for serotonin. They decrease substance P release and then decrease pain. So in adults, This is migraine without aura, called common migraine. You have to have at least 5 attacks lasting 4 to 72 hours. They always come in and say they have a headache here. They usually complain it's pulsating, moderate or severe pain intensity, aggravation by routine physical activity, and then they have to have one of the following. And this is kind of tricky, and I think it's going to be changed. Nausea and or vomiting, and then photophobia and phonophobia. And if you don't have both of those things, you have to say probable migraine. So they've gone back and they've looked at these criteria in children. Children often have much shorter headaches than adults. And as I said before, the kids always come in and they say their head hurts right here. And you don't have to ask them whether they have sensitivity to light or sound. You can assume that if they want to go in a dark room, that they have photophobia or phonophobia. Or if they look like they are pale and not doing well, you can infer nausea. Migraine with aura, called classic migraine, is about 20% of people with migraines. So often the aura runs in the family. I get a little bit more nervous about a kid with aura and bad headaches if mom or aunt or grandmother or somebody doesn't also have the aura. Typically, somebody with a migraine with aura will have many headaches without aura, but some of them with aura. So as long as they've had one migraine with aura, they can be classified as such. One of our surgeons, I won't even tell you the specialty because I don't want to make anyone look bad, but was started feeling very confused when he was getting ready to go operate. And he realized he was more and more confused, and he went into the room where all the kids were waiting to be operated on, and he kind of said, oh, I kind of recognize that person. And he went over and kind of tried to talk to the mom, and sure enough, they were waiting for him to do surgery. And then he went down towards the surgery room and couldn't find the room, and he was brought over to the emergency room at the university across the bridge from primary really quickly, thinking he was having a stroke. 3 MRIs later, nothing wrong. It turns out it was a confusional migraine, and he had actually had one more of those when he was like 11 years old. So migraine with aura, for him it was confusion. So the typical aura consists of visual and or sensory and or speech symptoms. They have to develop gradually. If it comes on like right away, then you start thinking more TIA or stroke. The duration is no longer than an hour, otherwise we start getting worried about other things. Usually they're a mix of positive and negative features. I'll talk a little bit more about that next slide. And they have to obviously be completely reversible. And then they have to be associated with the headache fulfilling criteria for migraine without aura. And again, in kids, they can have a shorter headache. So no motor weakness, that's really important, but it can also be really hard to differentiate. So the kid is walking funny, the parent will say, oh, they were weak on that side, but maybe they just couldn't feel anything on that side. So you really have to try to get at it because it changes the differential. So positive examples of aura are tingling in the arm, flickering lights, spots or lines, the fortification spectra. And I've learned over the years that if I don't specifically ask for aura symptoms, the patients don't volunteer it. They think everyone has flashing lights. So I really have to ask. And then negative examples, numbness, loss of vision, not being able to talk. Visual aura is the most common one we see, probably about 70%. Sensory disturbance is next, and speech disturbance is next. And so if they have motor symptoms, all this goes away. They have to be looked at very carefully for whether they've had a stroke. Familial hemiplegic or sporadic hemiplegic migraine is a diagnosis of exclusion. And you can do gene testing for it, but you only give them that if they've had it multiple times and no obvious stroke. Then there are also the childhood periodic syndromes. These are thought to be precursors of or equivalent to migraine. And they include cyclical vomiting, where kids will vomit for days, sometimes badly enough that they have to be admitted to the hospital. And then all of a sudden, they'll be better. Family history of migraine makes you feel better. They usually get big workups, but nothing is found. Abdominal migraine is just episodes of abdominal pain that are also cyclical. And again, they've had a GI workup, nothing was found. Benign paroxysmal vertigo of childhood, they get vertiginous for days, and then after a while, they feel better multiple times. And then the new one, colic is implicated. So I know lots of kids with colic that never got migraine, but now they're talking about colic potentially being a migraine precursor. That baby looks really unhappy. Okay, so evaluation of migraine. We have over the years gone to less and less of an evaluation. We don't think that most kids with migraine need much of an evaluation. If you're going to test the blood, what are you really testing for? What's your question? Do they really need an MRI? If it's a typical picture, they have a family history. So it's very rare that a child with a headache has an underlying etiology, although almost three quarters of them have CTs or MRIs before they even come to visit me. As we go to ACOs away from private pay, that's going to be a lot more of a problem. We're not going to have the luxury of doing that anymore. The major concerns are tumor, that's what the parents are always thinking, vascular malformation, spread of infection, and sinus thrombosis, but those things are really rare. And if you look at many studies, about 1% of kids who have MRIs or CTs for migraine have abnormal findings. And those are often not findings that we would act on, like a mild Chiari or an arachnoid cyst or something like that. And as you know, once you do an MRI and you find something like that, then they're often going to get more of a workup. So CTs really aren't very good for headache except in an emergency situation, and they can be bad for you. A typical adult CT of the head gives you 30 to 50 millegrays, which is a radiation absorbed dose measure. And in children, they've shown that cumulative doses of only 50 millegrays or 60 millegrays triple the leukemia and the brain cancer risk. And it also turns out that CT scans all over the country were leaking a lot more radiation than we had thought. We used to think they were a lot safer than we do now. So instead, a complete history, the family history, and the exams with the vital signs. And if you're going to do any imaging, except in an emergency situation, just do an MRI, don't do a CT. I can't tell you how many kids come in having had a CT, something's weird on it, and then they get an MRI. So then they get two tests instead of one. Any questions about evaluation? So I don't do EEGs, I don't do blood tests unless there's something specific in the history. Go ahead.
And we're being accused of treating rather than preventing. You mentioned the child that came back from gymnastics. Is it possible the headache could be due to hydration? Dehydration.
I will talk why about
not,
a lot
yeah,
of that
why
stuff.
Not pre- what about the indoor activity? Inhaling spores from the floor?
I'll talk why not, about
why
that
not,
too.
Why not encourage the kid to go jogging outside? And then what about cleaning out the sinuses in the shower when they've got colds? And then...
I didn't get that last
watch
one.
Watch out for the parent who's got nervous headaches herself and the child is trying to copy. Shouldn't we be spending more time in prevention rather than treating? It's so much easier to order a CAT scan or an MRI than talk about things that can be done to avoid the headache.
Well, actually, I'm just on my evaluation part of the talk, but I am getting to all that kind of stuff. So hopefully you will be happy.
We should really be doing this at the beginning.
My husband said that too when I did this talk for him. So I'll tell him that somebody else said that. So migraine treatment, there's no magic pill. And I tell people that kind of right away so I can set expectations. I make them journal their headaches. And when they come back without the journal, which they always do, I ask them for the journal. And then I have them come back another time with the journal. I need to understand the headaches. Having some vague thing like, I think she had two last month, just doesn't help me. Exercise is really important. If kids are staying home from school for migraine, I tell them they have to exercise 5 minutes of every hour while awake, because I don't want them staying home from school and just lying in bed all day. And then I often put them on regular exercise programs. Appropriate sleep. Many of the teenagers stay up till 12 o'clock at night because they've done something after school. They've gone to singing practice or something like that. Then they do their homework, and then they get up at 6 o'clock again to go to school again. So that's very important. Appropriate weight, which, again, I don't have much of a problem. Stress and anxiety are really, really important, and I will talk more about this. Diet, can't skip meals, even a protein bar will be better than nothing, and no narcotics. So Dr. DeGree's group in the adult headache group at the university are no longer seeing patients that are on narcotics in their headache clinic. They have to be taken off their narcotics before they can be seen. We're really serious about the no narcotics thing. I have a young girl that came in the other day with her mom. She hasn't been in school for 2 years. And she is on Diamox, topiramate, a couple of GI medications, tramadol, meloxicam, extra strength Tylenol, aspirin, because the mom thinks that she has factor V lidin, which she doesn't, and Lortab. And when I told the mom that she doesn't really need the Lortab, the girl said, "See, I told you I don't need that Lortab." I've never seen that particular behavior before where the mom was forcing it. But the narcotics thing, just don't go down that pathway. So I think that journaling is therapeutic on its own. It's part of mindfulness training, which I hear there's going to be something at lunch about. It makes people more understanding of their headaches. Some kids get a headache every weekend. They're so stressed during the week that the weekend comes and then the headache comes. And we actually think that there are differences in 5-HT in the spinal fluid that changes on the weekend when the stress goes away. Why stay away from narcotics? Because it's a chronic pain syndrome, and chronic pain isn't helped by narcotics. Often, narcotics makes it worse. We have good evidence that if you use narcotics more than a couple times a week, that the headaches start becoming more frequent and more intense.
About what?
Yeah, and medication overuse, and I'll talk about that. But narcotics seem to be worse. You also have to look to see if it's young women, whether they have an association with their periods, or maybe they have a whole bunch during soccer season and they're better the rest of the year. This is a smartphone app. There are a lot of others. Sometimes I can get the teens to do it on their smartphone when I can't get them to do it without, just writing on a piece of paper. I had a young lady come in whose parents were both, hopefully no parents are here, both doctors in a different state, and they were coming for a third opinion about headaches, and they had tried everything. She'd had several hospital admissions, she'd had steroids, she had IVDHE. I really didn't have that many other ideas, but she was getting up at 3 every morning to be at swimming practice by 4:30. And swimming for a couple hours in the morning, going to school, swimming some more, coming home and doing her headache. And when I suggested that the swimming might be the problem, the mom got quite angry and annoyed with me and said, "Well, you know, that's her ticket to college." So I agree with the kinds of things you're talking about. We make our kids do too many activities. So in terms of headache, and this is where my husband told me I should do the preventive first. There's acute, rescue, and preventive. So acute care and rescue is what we think of what somebody takes if they get a migraine. And preventive is medication that somebody takes every day to decrease the headache frequency and intensity. It's a little bit different in kids. The American Academy of Neurology recommends very quick use of triptans for adults, but we don't tend to do that in kids. They need to take it as soon as possible after the headache starts. You only have about an hour, hour and a half max, that a triptan will work, maybe a little bit longer if it's a non-steroidal. And you can't do it more than 3 times a week, a combination of, you know, 2 triptans and Tylenol or 3 Tylenol or all those things together, not more than 3 times a week because of medication overuse headache. And a lot of times these kids are taking their medicine to school in a backpack. And I had one child that got suspended for 2 days for having medication in his backpack. So they need to get you a form that you can fill out. It's usually a district form so they can have this at school. So I just use ibuprofen, acetaminophen, naproxen. Often the family are not giving the appropriate, so they're giving 200 to a 15-year-old male who's in football. It's not going to work. Addition of caffeine may be helpful. I have this one mom who gives a shot of cappuccino to her child when she starts with a headache and a little bit of ibuprofen, and she gets better. Admittedly, that's not what everyone's going to want to do, but it works for them. I also check to see whether they have problems with nausea and vomiting. I use Zofran ondansetron generally. So it has actually serotonergic properties. So it's not only treating the nausea and vomiting, it's treating the headache. And that's true of some of these other, of some of these other medications as well. But not all of them. Metoclopramide, Reglan, also treats headache as well as the nausea and vomiting. Ondansetron comes in orally disintegrating tablets, which is wonderful if you're throwing up. It's really hard to swallow medication and keep it down if you've already started throwing up. However, a lot of times insurance won't pay for it unless you write a letter saying you've already tried the tablets and it didn't work. And that's probably just going to get worse. If I use Thorazine, I usually pre-treat with Benadryl, but I actually haven't had any problems with dystonic reactions. So like I said, I use the triptans pretty rarely for headache. They're very expensive. They're often not covered by insurance. And the insurance panels will often have a couple of triptans that they like to use. And they don't necessarily include the ones that I use for kids. If they're combined with ibuprofen and acetaminophen, they may work better. And Trexamit does have naproxen and sumatriptan. I've had really a hard time getting insurance companies to allow that, though. So when sumatriptan, which was the first triptan looked at in adolescence, was tried, oral tablets did not seem to work, only the nasal spray. Kids will not do the nasal spray. These adolescents just will not. They say it tastes horrible, and they say it kind of hurts. So I try the tablets. Sometimes it works. I've had some kids actually want to do the sub-Q shots more than they wanted to do the nasal spray. Rizatriptan is approved in children 6 years and older, and it comes in orally disintegrating tablets, 5 and 10 milligrams. Adults can repeat those, kids can't repeat. And amitriptan comes in these capsules, and that's for kids 12 years of age and older. The kids that I usually do this with are ones with moms who are on triptans, and they come in specifically wanting those medications. I don't really have anything against it, but I feel like the ibuprofen and stuff works pretty well. Sometimes you have to get more aggressive. They call the office, they've had a headache for 2 days. So this is a kind of, this so you can rest. I will do Benadryl and Phenergan on a scheduled basis just so they can sleep for a couple days. And it's the last step before I have the kids go into the emergency department. In the packet that you guys have, I put our ED protocol, and that was worked out between the Division of Pediatric Neurology. I think there's some around on the tables. It was a joint effort, so they don't have to call us for all the kids with migraine. They just go through our standard protocol. They only call if it doesn't work. It's essentially a cocktail of an antiemetic, an antihistamine, and anti-inflammatory, usually ketorolac. Seems to work really well in most kids. Sometimes we admit kids for IVDHE. We just finished a study of 10 years of IVDHE admissions at Primary Children's. We really did pretty badly. It costs about $7,500 for each admission. We do get psych and stuff involved during those admissions, and sometimes the families do not want to have psych or behavioral health or anything involved. So sometimes it's worth it just doing it for that. But we're changing the protocol, and hopefully we will get a lot better. We're going to try to have more beds available to do this more quickly, more like the University of Cincinnati does it, rather than waiting until these kids have already had headaches for 3 years. Huh? Oh, I'm sorry. Dihydroergotamine. So old-time medication. Has to be. We were doing PICC lines, and so that made us less likely to admit them and do that. Now we're just trying IVs again and going by the University of Cincinnati protocol. It makes them sick to their stomach. Usually we pre-treat. When they come in, we make them have a quiet bedroom. They cannot have their 10 friends there, no screen time. And then we also have dietary psychology and integrative medicine. Do you guys know about the integrative medicine division at Primary Children's? No? It's really exciting. It is. They work on complementary and alternative medication. They can do acupressure or acupuncture. They do essential oils. They try to teach people biofeedback. So again, it's kind of this prevention stuff. They're trying to get the people, the kids, to learn how to relax, learn how to reduce their own stress. We live in a stressful world, so they can't get rid of all the stress. It's more our reactions to the stress that are important. Because it's at primary, insurance has been really pretty good about paying for things like acupuncture, which they're not willing to do often in the community. Kids have really liked it. So preventive medication, and this is what I would recommend doing instead of narcotics. Way, way underprescribed. So if you have a headache 3 days a month, or one headache that lasts 3 days a month, we recommend preventive medication. We think that not only does this help the child at the time, but we think it prevents chronification of the headache. So when they're 40, they're not on disability for headache. They're not taking medications all the time. They're not just disabled from having headaches. And we think it's really important to get this started. Takes 4 to 8 weeks to work, and you have to warn the families of that, otherwise they start taking the medication and they stop in a week because it isn't working and they never come back to see you again. Or they talk badly about you in the community. There's no evidence in children and adolescents. That's not because I don't think it works, but nobody's ever bothered to do those studies. It's expensive to do them, nobody's ever looked. Except for flunarizine, which is a calcium channel blocker, not available in the United States. But there is good evidence in adults, and it seems to work in kids as well. So this is the list of what I call the usual suspects. So for almost all the headache types, it's the usual suspects. So complementary and alternative medications, cyproheptadine, topiramate, and amitriptyline are the ones I use the most. The CAM possibilities, there's actually class one evidence for magnesium, that taking magnesium every day, whether you have a headache or not, helps decrease the frequency and intensity of headaches. And in adults, it's 200 to 400. The only side effect is sometimes they get loose stools. And I just kind of look at the size of the kid, think 200 to 400 in an adult, you look like about half of that, and I do 100 BID, and I'll go up if necessary. Pedicites or butterbur was really popular for a while. You can get it from Amazon.com, and you can get the Pedidolex form, which we know is the same every time. I wouldn't get the preparations from China or India, but there's more concern about toxicity with this these days, so I've kind of stopped using that. Riboflavin. There's new evidence that melatonin given every day for prevention of headaches, not sleep, might be helpful. And vitamin D seems to help kids. Sometimes I check a level. But almost everyone I check these days seems to be low.
Do you have a dose recommendation for melatonin?
It's 3 milligrams. It's just the little tablets you get at the GNC. So there are chewables. That I just tell them to get the chewables, and they're 1 milligram. I do tell them when I do that, though, that I've had a couple of kids, because we use it a lot in children with autism, that have eaten the whole bottle because the chewables are so good. So I always warn the family, like, don't leave them around. So cyproheptadine, when I first started doing headache, I was like, oh, those pediatric neurologists that I'm working with, they're so conservative, there's no evidence. It actually has more serotonergic properties than other antihistamines. And in little kids, I really think it works. The GI docs use it to make kids gain weight, so they gain weight. So you don't want to use this on an older child, 10 or older, who already has a weight problem. But the little kids, up till about 10, and I only use it at night. It only needs to be given at night. It makes you sleepy. Most of these kids aren't sleeping very well, so I think that's a good side effect, but only up till about 10. Then amitriptyline, I do an EKG usually, to make sure it doesn't have long QT. We actually had a child that was seen for fainting and seemed to be doing fine. They checked an EKG, it was high, nobody noticed it, and she was at a dance recital and went into cardiac arrest. And luckily people were right there and she's fine now, but I've gotten really nervous about long QT because now there's new evidence that topiramate is also causing long QT syndrome. We only give that at night, so I think the sleepiness, again, is good. And the teens seem to do really pretty well with that. And it's about 1 milligram per kilogram that we do. Topiramate's the other one. Unlike with seizures, we only give it once at night. People call it topastupid and dopamax, but usually that's not too much of a problem when we give it only at night. I do warn them that they're going to have tingly hands and feet, and it avoids many emergency phone calls in the middle of the night. My daughter's hands are tingling. what do I do? And they have to increase hydration a lot, really important. There's a theoretical effect of kidney stones. Haven't seen one. I rarely use propranolol because so many kids have asthma and I worry about these kids being depressed, but I put the doses in anyway. You can go to a extended release preparation if it's high enough. So we're doing a bunch of studies right now that I thought I would also talk to you about. The mindfulness study is come and done. So we have a group of 20 young ladies between 12 and 16, and they met with occupational therapists, yoga people, over the course of 8 weeks for a couple hours once a week. And the kids loved it. They met other kids kind of with the same problems and did a lot better. Completely not medical, but their headaches really got a lot better. We're hoping to do it. We were able to offer that free because it was a study, so now we're trying to find funding. Have you guys heard of FL41? Those are the rose-tinted lenses. Dr. Degree uses them a lot for adult headache, but there's a new kind out here. It's a thin film coating, and they're doing a study in adults, and we're doing a study in kids. They get to pick which glasses they like. We kind of have like Oakleys that they get to pick. Some of the adolescent females will say, oh, those are ugly, won't do them. But they seem to really help. A lot of these kids are very photosensitive. And if you see a lot of kids with migraine, you can tell that you can really look in their fundi really well because their pupils seem to be larger. And that might be why they're photosensitive. And then we're doing the CHAMP study, which is out of the University of Cincinnati, comparing amitriptyline to topiramate to placebo. So nobody's ever looked at that before. And when I talk to families, I say, we could do amitriptyline, we could do topiramate. And they say, which one is better? And I say, I have no idea. And then starting next week, I'm going to be able to say, I have no idea, but you can help us find out. That's my pitch. So then, chronic daily headache. This is why I decided to go into headache medicine. I dreaded these kids. These are the kids that come in and have had headaches for 2 years. They haven't been in school. They're not doing anything else in terms of sports or outside activities. They look depressed. We all dreaded these kids, and I felt like if we had a more substantial headache clinic, we would be able to do better with them. So to have a chronic daily headache, you have to have headaches 15 days a month or more. And I know that doesn't really make sense, but that's the definition. And we think that they're complications of migraine or transform migraine. And in fact, the coding calls this a complication of migraine. I think that can often come from kids that have tension headaches, not just from kids that have migraine headaches. And they often lose their migrainous features over time. So this is a chronic pain syndrome. And probably everyone here sees people, and some, no matter what you do, these people with chronic pain that just come in, their lives are destroyed or at least hurt. And it's about 1/3 of adults. So this is pain that ceases to be symptomatic of the initial cause and becomes an entirely separate condition. And this, again, is one of those things we want to treat early to prevent chronification. So by this time, the kids have completely altered mental states and they're physically dysfunctional. And there's a lot of new research going into these networks. And in fact, drug companies are now, instead of having things like developed against the glutamate receptor, they're developing them against the glutamate network or the default mode network. We think they're important in autism. We think they're important in headache. And we think that it changes the resting excitability in these kids. You should be looking, more medication should be coming out aimed at those in the future. These kids are also, by this time, they're having very negative affect and they kind of catastrophize everything that happens to them. So medications are important in this group of kids, but more important is the behavioral health or the integrative medicine that I talked about and cognitive behavioral therapy. And now there's actually a study that came out of the University of Cincinnati that shows this. So they did headache education and medicine in one group and CBT and medication in another group to give them each equal time and attention. And the CBT kids did a lot better. And so I bring copies of that journal article to clinic because nobody wants to go see a psychologist. And I show them and I'd say, your headaches are not going to get better unless you do this. It's a hard sell. So therapy for this is the usual suspects, like amitriptyline and topiramate. But new for chronic daily headaches is the botulinum toxin protocol. It's only approved down to 18, but we're using it down to age 15. And they come in and they get 31 shots, forehead, then kind of the sides of the head and around the back. We're having wonderful success with this. So they come in and they do a series one. 2 or 3 months later, they do series two. And usually by that time, they're doing a lot better. And then they spread out the next one. So maybe in 6 months, they call and say, it's time to get in for another one. We don't think that's just affecting muscle. We think that the Botox gets taken up by anterograde transport into the cell and then goes back out. So to the trigeminal nerves that go to the meninges and the vasculature. There's also a new headband called Cephaly. You can get it from Amazon.com for about $400. I'm not sure if insurance is going to be paying for it yet. It's essentially a TENS unit. And then there's no evidence, but a lot more people, including at primary and at the university, are doing more injections like greater occipital nerve. So I think I told you this. So most common side effect is neck pain. So I can see kind of skeptical faces out there. And sometimes I ask myself, if this is the way the kids' headaches are going, is it that I make them better because they're on the top and they're going to get better anyway? And I truly don't know. But I do try these things. But it's a really difficult area because the evidence is so hard. There's a 50% placebo effect in anything you do. So it's hard to find a medicine that helps. So really important is treating the anxiety and the depression and the sleep disorders. I tell them that treatment involves going back to the school. They have to go back to school, even if it just starts with a couple hours a day. Often these families have lots of issues. I have this one, actually it was the tramadol Lartab family. The dad was home on disability for fibromyalgia, and two kids that have been out of school for 2 years. And we're working with this family, but with that kind of family dynamics, the only thing I can really think of that might help is getting those kids out of that house. They want those kids to be disabled. That's what the family does, that they like that. And we get social work, psychology, and psychiatry. There's also an education person at primary that's really nice to get in if they've been out of school for 2 months to help them get back. I already talked about that one. Okay, so in summary, the general principles are sticking with the family. I tell them I don't have any magic pills. This is trial and error, but I will keep seeing you and we'll keep on working on it. We talked about school and the behavioral health. So our division wrote a module with all this kind of stuff in it, which is on the medical home portal that I've been involved with for years. It's www.medicalhomeportal. And then you go up here to diagnoses and conditions, and then you get the headache module. So there are lots of resources on that, including headache apps, the ache.net site, mindfulness, where you can get biofeedback around here, all that kind of stuff.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
You said sometimes parents want the children to have the problems, health problems, and you recommend getting them out of the home. What do you personally do when you feel like that's the case?
When they want the child to have problems?
If I heard you correctly, you said something about getting them out of the home.
So that's a very rare family that wants their child to have problems, and that's usually because that family has kind of organized around disabilities in that family. And that doesn't happen just with headaches. It happens in very rare families with things like cerebral palsy. And I am not very, I don't have that much to offer. I can do medications, but at that point, social work and psychiatry and stuff needs to get involved.
People so you just do you just refer them? Do you go to an agency? What do you personally do?
Well, if I feel like the child that I was talking about with the tramadol and Ultram, I think will eventually be a DCFS referral. I'm working with the chairman of my department right now about trying to do something. We have kind of a group of people at primary that will help with that. And maybe that will be successful, but that's kind of out of my expertise. Most families, of course, want their kids to get better, but you do have to kind of watch, I think, for those families. So I also, this is the very last thing. In that packet, I've put some other things. Blank headache diary sheets is the last page. So just in case you want to hand out headache diaries. It helps me to know how disabled the family is, and I will often have them do a PEDS MIDAS questionnaire, which is in there. It's real easy to get from the web. The pediatric symptom checklist screens for things like depression, anxiety, and other barriers to getting better. And I gave you the ED protocol. So hopefully, starting this summer, we will have psychology directly involved in every headache clinic visit. And at least one, the initial visit, there will be psychology to screen, to look for barriers. We're going to be revving up to do more inpatient as necessary. We're doing the Botox and other injections. And we will hopefully get better at treating these kids. We have, if people that are on HELP 2, we have a group neuro message log. So you go to neuro for the last name and then PEDS. And that's a way that you can just ask a question of anybody. Or you can call one of us on call to get a kid into our urgent clinic. Fast track we have for seizures, but we can get headache kids in sooner if necessary by calling the doc on call. We have a special doc now that just takes outside doc calls. They were calling it outside calls for docs and calling us OCDs, but we said let's not do that. And then I put a bunch of references. Questions?
I have a question. What role does diet management have these days?
So I don't think that a kid who gets up and eats sugary cereal and doesn't get anything like protein or fat and then gets hypoglycemic around 10 o'clock in the morning, and we just try to make sure that they have a good mix of things. And then some foods cause triggers for somebody. I don't have that many kids that have those triggers. They're often things like red wine or hard cheese that a lot of young kids aren't eating, but I have dietary kind of screen for all that. I think there's a big role. The teenagers are often skipping breakfast and lunch, so I get somebody to explain why they shouldn't be doing that. And then lots of, they need to drink lots of fluids. I think people are kind of chronically dehydrated, and that's a reason for a lot of the headaches. I don't want them drinking milk or juice, because that way they're just going to put on a lot of weight, and so the dietitian can work with that. I think kind of many questions. It's very individualized for each kid. But
by what age does the myelin covering of the trigeminum occur? And would all the dental workup affect all these headaches in children?
Dental? Did he say? So the trigeminal nerve is myelinated really early, because I would say before birth. Do you know that? Because you know you're able to open your mouth you're able to sense and you're able to move your muscles of mastication and stuff at birth. So I think already. And a lot of these kids have gone to the dentist, and some of them have had their TMJ fixed, or they've had other procedures, and then they still have headaches. There's a doc in Vernal who came to me for his son, and he had a mild Chiari malformation. They went on to see neurosurgery. He had the Chiari decompressed. They come back again. He still has the chronic daily headaches. So it's really kind of a diagnostic odyssey for a lot of these kids. That, you know, they go to all these other subspecialties, and then in the end, you know, sometimes people do have TMJ dysfunction and they get better, but sometimes they still have headaches.
In adults, in adults with chronic pain, I believe, and there's some evidence on this, I think, that
you believe
the set point for what feels to be painful has altered. So we often send those adults to an aggressive exercise program, often with martial arts, to try and work on that. But we also find that the empowerment issue is really important. Do you feel that those are strategies we can take in children?
Yeah, so a lot of these kids do exercise a lot. In fact, that's kind of the problem. But I agree, and the kids that aren't exercising, exercise is really important. there's a new paper out in Cephalgia about fear of pain and how the kids with migraine might have more fear of pain, and that might be one of the things that makes them chronify. But so many of these kids are they're over-engaged in sports and other activities that if I ask them to go do another exercise program, I think I'm just making it worse. My kids went to Roland Hall, and I've gone to many a like end-of-the-year recital, which is a private school in Salt Lake, for those who don't know, and I'd look around and I'd say, well, I know her, and I wouldn't say this to my kids, but I'd be thinking to myself, you know, I know five of the kids that are performing here tonight, and I also tell the kids, it's not the boys that sit in the back of the class getting the C's and D's that come in to see me, it's the A's, and so I always ask, are you really good at school, and oh, yeah. And they also, the kids are actually more willing to fill out the headache diaries than the parents often, because they're a little bit OCD, especially if they have an app.
What percentage of the pediatric headaches resolve into adulthood? I mean, is there a percentage that go just away?
We don't really know that, but we think it's pretty high. And that's the whole thing with the preventive medication and chronification. So many of my 16-year-olds will go on to Dr. Degree's group.
Just a quick question. I mean, when you said Dr. Degree's, you know, we send a lot of our patients down that way, and sometimes they come back on methadone just on a scheduled basis for their headaches. I mean, I was appalled at that. Is that
so? Were they on narcotics before?
No. Well, they tried everything, and basically, that's what they were sent
so
back.
That sounds to me like they also went to the pain clinic, but
well, it was Dr. Degree's clinic, so I didn't know if that was a policy. You know,
no,
I've never heard that before.
No, they will not take people with narcotics anymore. Yeah, I don't know about that. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Sure.
In your experience, what's your opinion with prescribing Furanol or Furoset?
The strategy of what?
The strategy of prescribing Furanol or Furoset, the butalbital combination for tension headaches, maybe?
So I don't use narcotics.
Just never.
And so we think that butalbital and Furoset and those things, they actually need fewer of those in a week to do the chronification. Every once in a while, if I've tried like everything else, I'll try steroids. It's not one of my first go-tos, but you know, sometimes you kind of do whatever you can think of. I don't know if it works. Sometimes it does seem to work, but there aren't any good studies. But we'll try anything for some of these kids.
Question?
Sure. So yeah, so you start with one here and one here. Every once in a while, we get a little bit of a droop of an eyebrow, but very few. And then they're injections.
Could you repeat the question, please?
We wanted to know about botulinum toxin. And then injections all around the shoulders. And it seems to work.
It's done in one session?
The needle is, you know, hard, you can hardly see it, and it's one syringe, and you just put a little bit in every one. We had the Allergan guy come out and go through it with us. I think it's Allergan. Yeah. And really, they were really helpful to do that. They bring this little head, and you practice doing water, and the side effects are very few. It's not that much. Often, insurance companies won't let you do it until you've tried two preventives. But there have been families that have not wanted to do oral medications at all that I've been able to write a letter and allow them. And we were really skeptical at first, but it really seems to help. But I don't have numbers. About a week. But sometimes families need two sessions. But in our experience, they do feel relief after the first. But not right away, like not right that moment.
I have a question, a follow-up on that. When you're doing that head stuff, are you putting it in acupuncture points? Are you putting it through the sutures?
The botulinum toxin?
Uh-huh.
No, it's just right in the skin. It's just little sub-Q injections.
Right, but do you know those places? Are they precise, or are you just doing it anywhere?
kind of doing it anywhere. We're just trying to get, so it's a prescribed series of 31 injections by the company that was FDA approved, and we try to, you know, do as carefully as we can, but it's not, you know, so you go to the ear and you go back a little bit, and you don't have to, you can do it in 5 minutes. You don't have to have it real precise.
Thank you.
Okay, I think I'm done. Thank you.